once they go to Vrindavan, then they'll stay there for the duration of their pilgrimage. I think they'll miss two more Sundays, and then they'll be back the third Sunday from now. So Pyari's in India, Jiva's in the kitchen, so we can do anything we want in the temple. It's all ours. So I thought what we would do would be read a verse in Bhagavad Gita. So if you want to hand out copies of Bhagavad Gita as it is, we're doing the verses in order, so we'll just continue. Hopefully I got the right verse. So it's chapter 2, text 59. Chapter 2, text 59. In my book, it's on page 147. It might be different than yours. Okay, chapter 2, text 59. So I'll read the Sanskrit first, the verse. Visaya vinivartante niraharasya denaha rasa varjam raso pi asya param dirstva nivartate. You can repeat after me. Visaya.
Visaya.
Objects of sense enjoyment. Vinivartante. Are practiced to be refrained from. Niraharasya. By negative restrictions. Nenaha. For the embodied. Rasa varjam.
Giving up the taste.
Rasaha. Sense of enjoyment. Api. Although there is. Asya. His. Param.
Far superior things.
Drishtva.
Drishtva.
By experiencing. Nivartate.
He
ceases from. So I'll read the translation and you can listen. The embodied soul may be restricted from sense enjoyment, though the taste for sense objects remains. But ceasing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, he is fixed in consciousness. So you can repeat after me. The embodied soul, may be restricted, from sense enjoyment.
Though
the taste for sense objects,
remains.
But
ceasing such engagements,
by experiencing,
a higher taste,
he is fixed in consciousness.
So I'll read
the purport by Srila Prabhupada. Unless one is transcendentally situated, it is not possible to cease from sense enjoyment. The process of restriction from sense enjoyment by rules and regulations is something like restricting a diseased person from certain types of eatables. The patient, however, neither likes such restrictions nor loses his taste for eatables. Similarly, since restriction by some spiritual process, like Ashtanga Yoga, in the matter of Yama, Niyama, Asan, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, and so forth, I guess Samadhi is the last, is recommended for less intelligent persons who have no better knowledge. But one who has tasted the beauty of the Supreme Lord Krishna in the course of his advancement in Krishna consciousness no longer has a taste for dead material things. Therefore, restrictions are there for the less intelligent neophytes in the spiritual advancement of life. But such restrictions are only good until one actually has a taste for Krishna consciousness. When one is actually Krishna conscious, he automatically loses his taste for pale things. So again, the verse in English, the embodied soul may be restricted from sense enjoyment, though the taste for sense objects remains. But ceasing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, he is fixed in consciousness. So in this verse, Krishna is talking about controlling our senses, right? Our desires for material gratification. And the intelligent person could ask, why? You know, why would I be interested in controlling my senses? If it feels good, do it. You get so much pleasure, thinking about so much pleasure or enjoyment from your senses, material senses, why would we want to restrict it, limit it? You know, is God being a killjoy? Is he trying to take the pleasure away? Why is he going to restrict our, you know, gratification of our senses? A few verses later, two or three verses later from this one, Krishna explains in nice detail what the risk is here. And there's a whole chain of events that follows if we get attached to our material senses. And that chain of events is we get lusty, then we get angry, then we get bewilderment of memory, loss of intelligence, and finally we fall back down to the material pool. So it's a whole litany of negative things that happen to us, all kinds of suffering, unhappiness, that is going to result from trying to gratify our material senses. So there is a lot at risk. I think we could summarize, you know, that whole chain of events as saying really it's a matter of separation from God. If we choose the material path, we're going to live our life separate from God. If we choose the spiritual path, we'll live our life in union with God. So it stands to reason that it's going to be much more pleasurable for us. We'll be happier following the spiritual path and having a connection with God. So that's really what's at risk, being separated from God, which is about, it's probably a fate worse than death. It's about the worst thing you can think of, you know, living your life that way with no connection to your creator. And we'll talk a little bit later on about what that relationship is, maybe, and develop that a little bit. But I just wanted to present that because, especially at the beginning, when we're understanding scripture and philosophy, it is good to question, I mean, to have legitimate questions and concerns before we accept everything. And so, you know, let's analyze that a little bit before we just say, oh yeah, it says it's a good thing to control our senses, so let's control them. So let's find out what's behind it, you know, the logic of why Krishna is saying this. And it'll become clearer to us as we go on the next few verses over the next few weeks. So once now that we've accepted that there is a lot at stake, at least we're interested in exploring it further. Maybe we're not convinced yet about what I said or about what Krishna is saying, but it should, for an intelligent person, it should get your attention with all what's at stake. So how do we do this? How do we control this? And how do we have a loving connection with Krishna instead of being separate from Krishna? Well, I think that in the purport, the very first sentence that we read is kind of the bottom line. Unless one is transcendentally situated, it is not possible to cease from sense enjoyment. So there's the answer, is to be transcendentally situated. We have to be transcendental. Now that sounds like a nice thing to be, you know, to be transcendental. I'll be floating around and so forth. But we have to understand, as the verse says, we're embodied individuals. So right now our soul is in a body. We are the soul and we're in a body. That's not always the case. When we're liberated, we don't have this physical body, this material body anymore. But right now we find ourselves living in the material world with all these material activities and the material energy right in front of us. So we have to cope with it. And we have to understand how to live with it and actually how to overcome or transcend it. So there are the three modes of material nature, right, that we're confronted with in this world. There's ignorance, passion, and goodness. And a lot of our motivation is driven by those things. When we want to gratify our senses, it's driven by usually ignorance or passion or some idea of being, you know, good, but for material benefit, you know, that kind of goodness. One way of thinking of sense enjoyment the term, the Sanskrit word, let's see, visaya, objects for sense enjoyment. Elsewhere, Prabhupada explains that that stands for, among other things, it stands for some of the basic drives that we have, eating, sleeping, defending, and mating. Okay, all the animal kingdom. Those are basic things, you know, for survival, but also that we derive material enjoyment out of. Now, of course, as humans, we endeavor to go beyond those basic animal kind of drives or instincts. If all we did were those things, sleep, eat, mate, and defend, we'd be no better than an animal. I mean, any animal can do those things. So we have the human body, we have human mind and intelligence, so we can inquire about other things like spiritual life. We can inquire about who we are and who God is and what our relationship is with God. Unfortunately for the animals and the plant life and so forth, they don't have that capacity. We do, and so we shouldn't squander it. We shouldn't waste it. So we want to transcend these material modes of nature, this material world, the material life. And in the verse, it's termed as a matter of consciousness. Right? We want to improve our consciousness. And of course, it's going to be Krishna consciousness. It's going to be our method. And that will help us answer who we are, who Krishna is, and what our relationship is with Krishna. And also in the verse, it talks about a higher taste. this is a subtle point, I think, that I know I missed early on as a devotee. It's kind of a subtle point that kind of the first step is to restrict or limit material desires or sense gratification. But that's only a first step. And we have rules and regulations to do that. Even the karmis, the materialists, often, most of them, seek some restriction of sense gratification. You know, some boundaries, some do's and don'ts. For example, and what am I talking about? For example, karmis will say, yeah, you know, materialists will say, it's okay, you know, to drink socially, just to have a drink or two with friends, you know, and maybe you get feeling good, you get a little happy, but you don't get, you know, falling down drunk. That would be wrong. Get falling down drunk or to drive drunk and get into an accident, that would be frowned upon. So we don't want to be excessive. Drink in moderation kind of is the message. So there's some propensity there to limit or restrict these what I'll call sinful activities, these sense enjoyment. Same thing with smoking. Now we pretty much, society says don't smoke, and it's a no-no. But when I grew up, it was again in moderation. You don't want to smoke so that you get lung cancer, but you know, I'm just going to have a few and I'm going to quit when I get older anyway. So you know, kind of, it was kind of accepted. I mean, I remember growing up in my house, my mother smoked consistently. My father smoked when he could bum a cigarette from somebody. He never bought them, but my mother had them. You know, she used to send us to the store to buy it for her. When I was growing up, we had like you'd have a candy dish on the table. In my generation, there used to be a nice ceramic dish filled with cigarettes for company. Actually, had free cigarettes when you come over, so you give them a drink and give them a cigarette. So, I mean, you see, the culture has changed a lot, especially American culture. I'm not so sure about Europe and elsewhere. It might still be more acceptable to smoke. But again, you know, it's kind of a, when you're young, the teenagers, it's almost a fun thing to do, or they think they look older doing it or whatever. But there's always this thing, you know, you don't want to harm your health in doing it. Any kind of addiction, you know, recreational drugs is okay, but don't become addicted. Don't have it so it ruins your life or whatever. Same thing with sexual activity. You know, it's okay if you practice safe sex. You can have a lot of different partners, but if it's safe sex, you know, so nobody gets pregnant, nobody gets sick, you know, it's okay. So there's some kind of regulation, but what the, you know, materialist culture doesn't understand or doesn't accept is that even in moderation, poison is poison. Wrong is wrong, sin is sin, even in moderation. So these things are sinful activities. They happen to be bad for our health. Most of what we're talking about here, the examples, are also bad for our health. But they also are a way to keep us separate from Krishna. Any kind of intoxication, you know, intoxicants where you're not in your right mind, you know, what is that? You know, gambling is another example. Oh, you just buy a couple lottery tickets, that's okay, or play bingo, you know, once a week or whatever, but don't get have a gambling problem. You know, don't to the point where you gamble away your paycheck or you lose your job because you can't restrict your gambling. And so anyway, the point of that is that even among a material society, there's, you know, some idea about regulations and restrictions. They don't go far enough, and they don't understand that you have to abstain from these things. You know, something wrong is wrong in moderation as well. But the point I want to make about the subtleness here, even for a devotee, is although we have our rules and regulations, right, we have the regulative principles that following the parampara, Prabhupada has given us four major regulative principles, right? No meat eating, no illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication. So we have these rules and regulations, and devotees will follow them. We happen to have those as official vows when we get initiated, but all devotees, whether you're initiated or not, should strive to follow those regulative principles. It isn't just for initiated devotees. In fact, it helps prepare you, cleanse you, purify you for initiation. Helps you know, get ready for initiation. So you should start that immediately. Don't wait for initiation. Anyway, but even for a devotee now, you have to understand that even having these regulations and rules isn't sufficient. Number one, it might seem somewhat involuntary or forced on us. You know, so there's that aspect. We might feel that way, as you know, it's like it's another don't, you know, can't do this, they're depriving me of something. But even if you want to follow the regulations and so forth, because, you know, we're marginal entities, we're spiritual souls, but we're in contact with material energy, so we're subject to the influence. We can be swayed, affected by material energy. That there's going to still be some kind of hankering, some desire left over for these things if all we do is have vows and restrictions and regulations and let it go at that. If we don't have something better to replace it with, if we just repress or try to abstain from something without replacing it with something better, something higher, we're still, you know, subject to fail. Those of us that have conquered some of these vices know that, you know, the person that gives up smoking still has some kind of craving for smoking, you know, beyond that period of giving it up, and all the other activities we talked about, especially vices. There's always, you know, it could be subtle. It takes a while to cleanse your body out, your mind, your body, and also just to not want it anymore. What really helps is, like I say, to get something that's better that replaces it and that motivates you, and it's called the higher taste in the verse. Something positive. That's why when we get initiated, it's not just four don'ts, you know, four regulative principles. There's also the positive principle, the other thing that we promise to do, which is chant. Right. The other thing we do at initiation is we promise, make a vow to chant the Maha Mantra a minimum of 16 rounds a day, you know, sincerely, with love and devotion. And again, even if we're not initiated, we should also be chanting the Maha Mantra, because that's going to give us the higher taste that will conquer these other activities. You know, that'll help us to honor the vows and to maintain the rules and regulations and the restrictions. So it can't be forced. It has to be voluntary, right? When you are going to decide what you want to do, what kind of activities you are going to follow and so forth. It has to be voluntary. It has to be motivated. And that's what Krishna consciousness gives us. In fact, I have a couple of visuals here. Higher taste. Most of us can't hear the term higher taste without thinking about the book, right? There is a BBT book called Higher Taste. How many of you have seen or read the book before? Okay. Elle might have copies in the bookstore, but I highly recommend it. That's how I first heard of that term, the higher taste, was through this book. It's a really, really nice book. A lot of it is making the case for vegetarianism and scriptural basis, health basis, common sense, and so forth. And then it kind of evolves into higher taste, this kind of principle you can apply to other areas in your life, not just regulating the food that you take into your body, but the higher taste actually applies to all of our life. And then it kind of ends with some recipes, some very nice recipes, which in the old days I actually made a few of these recipes. So I highly recommend that. Now, the term taste, we have to develop a higher taste. Now that term, as used in the verse, really is kind of figurative. It doesn't mean just literal tasting of your tongue. It does mean that, but I think we have to realize that it's broader. We say a taste just means a liking for something, predilection for something. We're in favor of something, we want to do something, we're interested in something, we have a taste for it. Some people have a taste for the opera, they don't have a taste for rural areas, they say, or this and that, a taste. So it applies to preferences and so forth. So it applies to all of our senses, for example. Now, does anyone know, according to the Vedas, what the most difficult of our senses is to control? What do they say? Diane, you had your hand up.
The tongue,
that's correct. The most difficult sense to control is the tongue. There are two functions of the tongue. One is to taste, like tasting food or drink. The other is to vibrate. The tongue vibrates. And by vibrating, thus we can make sounds, we can speak, and we can sing and chant and so forth. So we can use the tongue in a positive way or in a negative way, right? For eating, we can use it to eat all sorts of things we shouldn't be eating that are contrary to spiritual life. But we can use the tongue to taste spiritual food, the prasada. So it's up to us. Same thing with vibrating. Prabhupada often talks about nonsense. He uses that term, talking nonsense. People talk nonsense. And really, it's anything that not talking about Krishna or Krishna consciousness or trying to forward or promote spiritual life is really nonsense. Some of it, of course, is worse nonsense than other. So we can choose to talk about other topics. We can choose to swear. But we can choose to just talk about material topics or sing rock and roll songs and so on and so forth. Or we can choose to vibrate the holy name, to chant and sing bhajans and so forth, and to glorify Krishna and to associate with each other, to talk about spiritual topics with each other. So we have the choice. The tongue can go either way, but it's said that that's the toughest one to control. So it is fitting that the higher taste, the book The Higher Taste, comes out as controlling the tongue, because that is the toughest one to control. And it does talk about both, prasadam, food, and it does talk about the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, so controlling the vibration of the tongue. But this extends to the other senses as well that can get us into trouble or save us. For example, the sense of smell. The proper way to control the nose, I guess, the sense of smell would be, for example, use it to smell incense that's been offered to Krishna. Very pleasing. Or flowers that have been offered to Krishna, perhaps on the altar. Or usually it's Sujata Prabhu who brings around the flower with the attar, the perfume that's been offered again to Krishna, and gives us like that, and then we can smell. So, there's all other sorts of things you can smell fancy perfume and so forth, or put on fancy perfume to try to attract somebody. Or you can do what I just described. It's up to you and how you want to use the sense of smell. So I would say that there also could be a book, The Higher Smell. If anybody wants to write The Higher Smell, you could do that. Of course, all of our senses then, so we have sound, we can hear. That's an obvious one. We can hear scripture, or you can hear the scripture being discussed as we're doing now. We can hear about Krishna's pastimes. We can chant, and when we chant, whether it's someone else chanting or ourselves, we can hear Krishna's name and the music that we have and so forth. So you can engage the ears. We know, we could think of a million examples of material engagement of the ears and to listening to things we shouldn't listen to. But these are some positive things we can do. And it goes on. What are we missing? The sense, whatever senses do we have? Sight. Okay. Sight. We have a lot of choices on what to look at. You know, what movies do we want to see? What television programs? What boy or girl or man or woman do we want to see? But we can engage our eyes, fix our eyes in the way you do in Krishna consciousness. For example, in this room I see paintings of Krishna and his associates and some spiritual masters. And we have, of course, Prabhupada's Murti. So sometimes you'll see a devotee will come offer obeisances to Prabhupada here in his Murti form and kind of meditate, sit there and meditate on Prabhupada and think reflectively, about Prabhupada. And it helps us to see his form. Especially these Murti forms are so real. Don't know how many times a visitor has come in and they, why isn't he moving? You've heard that before. Why doesn't he move? And of course, when the curtains open and the deities, that's the real payoff. We can use our eyes to see the deities. We can do this at home, too. We can have pictures of Krishna and his associates, and also we can have deities at home. And then we also have the sense of touch. So many things we can touch and get ourselves into trouble. We can constantly want to touch money. Bob Dylan had a song, forget the name of the song, but Bob Dylan sang, I thought it was so funny, he sang, they say that money talks. I say money doesn't talk, it swears. And money can get you into trouble. So we could like the feel of money, we shuffle cards and play cards, or I think what Diane was showing, we can touch our beads, right? We all have japa beads. I don't have mine with me now, but we can touch our japa beads, and that reminds us, get a feel for Krishna there when we're chanting japa. That taste, that feel. Actually, when you're on the altar, when you do arti, you also get that sensation when you're using paraphernalia to offer to Krishna, like the kamara and the peacock fan and the ghee lamp and so forth. You're actually, you're feeling the items, you're holding the items that you're offering. Of course, some pujaris in this temple, I guess it would be primarily Jiva, maybe Pari too, dress the deities, bathe the deities and so forth. So there's a nice way to engage that sense of touch. Now, am I missing any of the senses? Taste, touch, smell, sound. Did I miss any? I don't think so. Okay. Now, our challenge, actually, it goes beyond kind of like these kind of gross examples that I've been giving, smoking, drinking, illicit sex and so forth. Actually, we want to regulate all of our activities, all of our material activities. As devotees, we have to think about regulating all of our activities, because there's so many material activities we're engaged with, including work, for example. So there's a way to handle work if you're engaged in work. In Bhagavad Gita, in another place, Krishna mentions where you could offer the fruits of your labor to Krishna. So we could offer fruits of our labor, make donations to ISKCON, to this temple, and so forth. We could sponsor feasts, sponsor clothing for the deities, give towards the new temple fund and so forth, like that. So you actually, all of our activities in our family lives, want to regulate in our family lives and so forth. So I just want to make the point, it isn't just, like a materialistic karmi might think of those really vices. Oh yes, we drink in moderation, have sex in moderation, gamble in moderation, and so forth. And they might not think twice about what they're doing the rest of their life. So even, activities like entertainment can get in the way, sports can get in the way of spiritual practices, you know, whatever the obstacles are for you, work, you know, could be an obstacle, relationships with family or friends or our loved ones or our hated ones, whatever. You have to kind of take inventory yourself in your own life, you know, what's driving you. As devotees, the basic guideline that we have is very simple. Accept what's favorable for Krishna consciousness and reject what's unfavorable for Krishna consciousness. So that is the standard, the rule, the guideline that we want to keep in mind. And so now, we don't want to be fanatics, but we want to be, judicious about it. We want to be, you know, careful, make judgments and so forth. We don't have to be fanatic. I'm never going to look at the TV set again in my life, and then there's some either great tragedy that comes on or some important news story or some important information about a storm coming or something maybe that we should see. So I mean, you don't want to be too fanatical, but you know, as far as all these optional kind of movies and TVs, yeah, we should seek to limit and if you can, to do away with that as much as possible. I've had certainly have obstacles like that. A big sports fan, it's taken a long time, many years practicing Krishna consciousness to kind of wind that down a little bit. I'm not as avid as I once was. Even if the Dodgers are playing, I can still not watch them. But there's another verse where Krishna says, you know, we're in the material world, so we're going to make the best of a bad bargain. We all have natures, we all have a little bit different, we all are individuals, personalities. Some of us are more outgoing. Some of us are more introverted and so forth. Some of us lean more towards physical kind of work or good with our hands. Maybe that's our service. Others, maybe we're more intellectual or grammatical or whatever. So you got to see where you fit in and where your talents lie and dovetail that with Krishna consciousness. There's room for everybody in Krishna consciousness, you know, cooks and pujaris and book distributors. You know, if you're a good salesperson, you know, you can help distribute our books and so forth. You don't have to sell new cars. So in that verse, which I can't remember the verse, but Krishna says, you know, we all have a nature, so don't be artificial. Don't artificially renounce or try to be someone you're not. He says, what does repression accomplish? You know, you can't just repress yourself. That's not resolving anything. Okay, so we don't want to be guilty when it comes to these sense enjoyment of just repressing it and then resenting it. Like, no, yeah, I'm not going to watch any more TV, and you hate it every day that you're not watching TV. So maybe if you watch just a little, get it out of your system, you wouldn't think night and day about TV because you're not watching it. You might actually think about it no more. When I was a kid, we used to give up something for Lent, like a period of fasting in the Christian tradition. It's actually coming up soon. I think it's for 40 days. You give up something you like. It's supposed to be something, as kids, you try to give up vegetables or whatever. Your mother says, no, no, no. Give up pie or cake. Or give up a certain TV show. Give up something you like, or don't go to the movies. That's a real good one if you can do that for 40 days, not go to the movies, something like that. So it's a period of fasting. But I can tell you, as a kid, whatever we gave up, that's all we could think about. I gave up cake one time. I think it was pie, because I actually like pie better than cake. Gave up pie for dessert. And, you know, my mother maybe would have pie, you know, once every 2 weeks, 3 weeks anyway, but, you know, that one time in 3 weeks that she would have it, I was thinking about it that whole time. Was she going to have? What kind of pie is she going to have? Because I couldn't have it. So that's, you know, that's silly. It's just repressing it. What you got to do is get to the point where you develop a distaste for these, for sense enjoyment. Pie is a bad example. I don't mean a distaste for pie, but if we're talking about meat, yes, develop a distaste for meat. It's not just enough to say, okay, you know, Hare Krishnas have this regulation, they're vegetarians, and they have no meat eating, they abstain from meat eating. He's like, I wish I could, and so forth. You know, if you embrace Krishna consciousness and do it honestly and sincerely, both the religious aspect of it and the philosophy aspect of it, you should come to a point where you develop a distaste. If you haven't already in your own attempts, it should help you develop a distaste for it. Reading Prabhupada's books and all the harm, all the negative stuff that comes along with being a meat eater, and all the religious prescriptions there are against it, even in other religions and so forth. You can become enlightened, about these topics. So you'll actually develop a distaste for these things, and it'll be out of a positive motivation that you want to not engage in these activities. It'll be a good thing. And I know that happened to me in my own life. Just as I was getting interested in spiritual life, just as I was beginning to read Bhagavad Gita as it is for the first time, and thinking seriously about maybe I want to, improve my spiritual or have a spiritual life, just as I was going into that, I also was thinking somewhat already about being a vegetarian. And I was thinking more for health reasons, to be honest with you, and morality reasons. But by reading Bhagavad Gita as it is, I got the message from Prabhupada, and he really started feeling a distaste for meat eating because all the trappings, all the things that it follows from that, all the negative things about it that we've learned here in Krishna consciousness. So I actually was developing a distaste for it by reading that book, and that really helped me, gave me a positive motivation that actually superseded or excelled, was better than the moral, at least for me, than the moral or health concerns, was this tying it to spiritual life. And the same thing, that was, I think I was 31 years old when I did that, and then it took me 3 years more to give up smoking and drinking. I was still smoking and drinking. Not in moderation. I was smoking and drinking in moderation. And it was kind of winding down, but I was reading Prabhupada's books, I was chanting, I was not associating with devotees yet in my early 30s, and I really didn't have much interest in doing that, to be honest with you. But I did really like Prabhupada's books, and really liked Prabhupada, and liked the beads and the chanting. I thought that was neat. And so I was curtailing the smoking and the drinking. But I remember distinctly one day, I was reading Bhagavad Gita as it is. I thought to myself, this is ridiculous, such hypocrisy. I really like this person. I think he's a really enlightened, guru, spiritual master. And it's how offensive and insulting it is for me to be a drinker and a smoker, and then, be reading, even touching his books. Now, I wasn't drinking and smoking at the time I was reading. I wasn't that decadent, but it was still, later in the week or something, I was still doing. So I thought, this is ridiculous. I should make a choice. And fortunately, I chose Prabhupada and Bhagavad Gita. And from that moment on, because I had tried as a karmi, I had tried to quit smoking a couple of times on my own, and it just didn't work. But on the strength, again, I just remember where I was sitting. I was on a bed, sitting on a bed, all kind of looking up, almost imagining Prabhupada there. I thought, this is really, I thought it was actually, it would be better for me not to read his books than to continue drinking and smoking and reading, which isn't necessarily a good thing to think, because it's the reading of his books and the chanting that will cleanse you and get you to stop those things. So you don't want to ever give up Prabhupada or the Hare Krishna mantra. But I was thinking, I thought, I don't want to give it up. I'm just getting into it. So anyway, so I made that choice. So it really helped me. And I'm sure in your lives, you can think of examples of regulating your behavior, any kind of material activity, not necessarily the four regulative principles, but to any area in your life. And maybe when you were ill, maybe when you were in trouble, maybe when you were sad or depressed or whatever, turning to Krishna consciousness, turning it up a notch, getting deeper into it, doing more chanting, more reading, or more associating with devotees, helps you, to cope with any suffering or distress, or really just quandaries, problems, questions that you have. I know there's a devotee that comes here, I won't mention his name, but he's told me that during his lifetime, so often he is called Pyari, or comes to Pyari, for everyday life questions, because he finds Pyari's perspective, orientation, so helpful and enlightening. Even if it has to do with work or family or health or whatever, he consults with Pyari Mohan and or Jiva for that. And that's a good spiritual master. It's an indication of a good spiritual master, where the life isn't segmented. It's not just hardcore religious issues that you consult with a spiritual master, you know, your whole life plan can be guided and should be guided by the spiritual master. The principles of the spiritual. I remember one time I went to Denver, Colorado, and we have a temple there and we have a restaurant. Anybody been to the Denver temple? Yeah, that time they had a really nice restaurant. I don't know if they still have it, but I was on a business trip and I met somebody who was there, a woman who was there at the restaurant. She's a vegetarian, not part of ISKCON. She was doing her own thing. She had a guru, spiritual master, some kind of, you call it Indian or Hindu type of tradition. I can't even tell you what it was. But I mean, she was favorable towards Krishna consciousness. She knew about it, but came because the vegetarian restaurant was there and, engaged somewhat in the religious aspects, but she had her own thing there going on. So I asked her a little bit about it, and she said that she was following this person. He was a Westerner. And she said, but I really like the guidance that Guru Dave gives me. So I thought, oh, well, that's nice. Just like us, we call our spiritual master Guru Maharaj or Guru Dave. And I said, well, that's good. And then she was describing something, a situation they were in. And she said, I was asking, and then I asked Dave about this and so forth. And I said, now, Dave, who's Dave? She said, my guru. I said, oh, your guru's name is Dave? She said, yeah, D-A-V-E. So it wasn't Guru Dave. It was Dave like Johnny or Dave, guru. So I thought, okay, that's interesting. It was just Guru Dave. And I said, why didn't you ask him about this other thing that you're telling me about? Maybe it was a work issue or whether she should move or whatever. And she said, I only call him guru. Like there's times when he's officially the guru. And I relate to him as that. She said, when